Hey, look, if you come to my desk on a Sunday, you'll see like a stack of books. I love reading and I love researching for sermons. And these are just some of the ones of, I got no idea about science, right? I'll just be up front. I did chemistry and physics in the HSC, but that's the extent of my study of science. Here's a couple of books, just a couple, some of the big ones. This, For the Glory of God, Rodney Stark is a sociologist at University of California in America, and he looks at the rise of modern science and attributes it directly, as we will see, to the Protestant Reformation. There's a chapter, it's called For the Glory of God, How Monotheism Led to Reformation, Science, Witch Hunts, and the End of Slavery. Quite interesting, very interesting. Bunch of other books. This is Science and Religion, edited by Australian professor of science and religion at Oxford. Oxford put out all these, or Cambridge put out all these little books. There's a couple of chapters in here on the history of science. You might also want to look at that. The same guy, Peter Harrison's written a book on the history of science. I didn't even dip into this. It looked too long. But if, some of the things you have serious questions about tonight, particularly with regard to the history, point you in his direction, top-notch scholar on the history of science. And then there's a bunch of more popular-level books. This is Dinesh D'Souza, an American guy who's written What's So Great About Christianity, heaps and heaps of stuff on science and Christianity. Let me read to you some of the topic. So he looks at Christianity and reason, the roots of science, from logos to cosmos, Christianity and the invention of invention. He's got a chapter in here on the fable of Galileo, and he disputes the common story, which is that the church persecuted Galileo for his science. So there's that little book, kind of a bit more generally on engaging with the new scientists. And then there's this guy, John Lennox. Anything he's written, fantastic. Oxford mathematician, but one of the best preachers I've ever heard. Just has the ability to communicate very well. He's got a chapter in Gunning for God on science, and he's got this little book, God and Stephen Hawking. And I've got an e-book by him called, what is it, Robert or someone else? God's Undertaker, Aaron. That's it, God's Undertaker, which a lot of today comes from. Finally, our very own Kirsten Burkett, she's got this little introduction to science and Christianity, probably the most readable of them all. I've enjoyed them all. I just thought I'd be up front. I got nothing on this topic, scientific, but I hope to show you. I've got something to show you from the Bible on this topic. That's where I'm an expert, not an expert on science. Apologize if I get anything wrong scientifically, and kill me if I get anything wrong theologically, because I ought to know better. Anyway, maybe that's a little bit extreme, but all right. Let me pray, and then we're going to jump in. Heavenly Father, we pray that you would show us the impact of Jesus on our world. And in this area of science, which there's so much fable and myth surrounding it, and its relationship to religion, we pray that you give us clarity. Help us to understand what Jesus has to say about our world and why that may have provided fertile soil for the rise of modern science. It's in his name we pray. Amen. Well, you may have already just sneered and laughed at me, Jesus and science, Jesus' impact on science, because if you've heard what Richard Dawkins says, you may have believed what he says, and this is what he says. He says, the alleged convergence between science and religion is a shallow, empty, spin-doctored sham. I was reading an older, not too old, I think it was last year or the year before, a little piece by Peter Fitzgibbons in the Sydney Morning Herald. He says something really, really similar to that. And I think as we kind of come to this topic, we should apply what Dawkins says in another book of his to his statement here. If you've read Dawkins, one of the things he kind of repeats often is that whenever anybody comes and tells you something, he says you should ask them for evidence. And I guess, sadly, Dawkins doesn't heed his own advice on this point. And it's quite surprising, really, that he actually hasn't read up on history, Peter Harrison. He was professor at his own university on science and religion, never gets quoted in his books. Dawkins just doesn't seem aware of the history at all of the likes of the great philosopher and historian of science Alfred Whitehead and of Oxford professor Peter Harrison, who both argue convincingly that science arose out of a Christian view of the world, or what you'd call a worldview. So where would we go in Scripture to kind of see the fertile ground from which modern science arose? Well, I've chosen John chapter 1, and I think we kind of see a little bit of stuff there. It's not exhaustive, but we're going to have a look at some of the implications. But before I go on, I'll just tell you a little bit about this series. We're looking at Jesus' impact on history. Last week, we looked at his impact on compassion and saw, I think, convincingly that the history books show us that in a brutal world where there was much inhumanity, Christianity came in under the influence of Jesus' teaching and brought with it great humanity and compassion. That was last week. You can listen to the sermon on our website. This week, we're looking at science. Next week, we're looking at Jesus' impact on ethnic diversity and racial relations. I haven't started reading, but there's this one great book by a guy called John Harris on the Christian missions to Aboriginal peoples. Were they a good thing? I don't know yet. I'm going to read that book and have a look if it's got anything for us. Next week as well, I've got a friend coming who's a friend of mine who's going to America to work on a settlement Indigenous Americans. That's the word. So that'll be interesting hearing her testimony as well. But just before I go on, I hope it's clear in these sermons what this series is about. We're talking about not the impact of Christians on history, because to be honest, if we did that, the history would be very mixed, just as if you were writing the history of atheists in the world, it would be a mixed history. What we're looking at, and what I think is indisputable, is Jesus' impact on history. And so that's what we're having a look. So much so, he's had such an overwhelmingly positive influence. Historian H.G. Wells says this. He says, "I'm a historian." I wonder if you've heard this quote before. He says, "I'm a historian, not a believer. But I must confess that as a historian, this penniless preacher from Nazareth is irrevocably the very center of history. Jesus Christ is easily the most dominant figure in all history," says him. So that's what we're looking at. His influence, not Christians' influence, but the two somewhat, you see the effect of Jesus' influence as you look at Christians. And so today we look at the worldview Jesus taught, which was the fertile soil from which science sprung. And so have a look at John chapter 1, verse 1, in your outline it says, "In the beginning." Now what does that remind you of? Reminds you of Genesis chapter 1, "In the beginning God created the heavens and the earth." Now, John, the writer of this gospel, he takes us all the way back to creation. It's quite interesting. You read Matthew and Luke, where do they take you back to? The virgin birth, Jesus' birth. Mark doesn't take you back that far. He just takes you to Jesus' baptism. But here, John, he just goes all the way back to eternity past, to the very beginning. And notice that when the Bible speaks about the beginning, notice the Bible isn't so much concerned about how, the mechanics, not so much concerned about how, but why, the meaning. And so have a look at verse 1 again. "In the beginning," one more thing, it's interesting how the Big Bang was a theory. I think it was first put, I meant to look up this, I read so much, all the ideas are going around in my head, but I think the Big Bang was first, the theory first was come up with a Christian minister, Catholic minister, I think. He didn't call it the Big Bang, that name got attributed to it midway through last century. Picked up by a Christian guy, this theory of the Big Bang, and rejected for probably, I think, 50, maybe more years, rejected mostly because of the implications for theism. Secular scientists, they weren't happy with the idea of a Big Bang because it seems to corroborate that there was a beginning. You can kind of look that up. But here we have it. In the beginning was the Word. And the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was with God in the beginning. Through Him all things were made. Without Him nothing was made that has been made. And so point one, here we see the rational God. The first thing we notice of the relevance to science is the idea of a rationality behind our world, behind our universe. We see it when it says, in the beginning was the Word. Now the word John uses here for word, am I confusing you? The word, the Greek word for word being used here is the word logos. The word for the word in Greek when he wrote it down is logos. And so in the beginning was the logos. And the logos was with God and the logos was God. And this logos is the thing that created all things. Now it says the logos, this very, very loaded term in the day. Because in the philosophy of the time, the word logos meant something very, very distinct. When we hear the word logos, we probably hear the word logic, right? And that's kind of right, because what we're talking about here is the idea of reason or argument. But it's not talking about reason in general. The logos at the time had to do with the reason for being, the meaning of life. It'd be like John, the gospel writer, starting his gospel with, in the beginning was the meaning of life. And the meaning of life was with God, and the meaning of life was God. He was with God in the beginning, and the meaning of life created all things. It has that kind of currency to us today. The reason for living, the ultimate purpose of life. And the philosophers knew that in order to make sense of something, you had to understand its purpose. So imagine, you know, they in the time they had all these debates, the Greeks debated about whether there was this thing, that whether there was a logos or not, a reason, a meaning, a purpose behind life. You know, imagine tomorrow morning I wake up, go down to the front door, open the door, and in front of me is this massive machine. And it's got all these kind of wires and handles and kind of things like that. It's this great, big, incredible machine. And Maisie and Evie run up to the machine and they start kind of pulling on wires on the machine. What would I do? I'd tackle them and get them out of the way, because I don't know what the logos, what the reason behind this machine is. It could be just a big paperweight, or it could be, quite possibly, a bomb. And in order for me to understand how I should be towards something, I need to understand the purpose of that very thing. And if I don't understand the purpose, then I'll risk my life dealing with it. And so you see, the Greek philosophers, they were asking for years and years, they debated not about the purpose of this machine, they debated about the purpose of life. Is there a meaning to life? Is there a logos in the universe that will make sense of life? Plato and Aristotle, they had their opinions. Everybody had their opinions. But by the time of Jesus, most of the philosophers had fallen into despair and decided that, I guess, there isn't any logos. You can't really be certain. And so you have the Epicurean philosophers who said, well, we don't know if there's a purpose to life. There is no purpose in life. There's no absolute reason for anything. And therefore, we ought to just have a great time while we live on earth. And that kind of philosophy has kind of seen a resurgent today, right? We don't really know what the meaning of life is. And therefore, we have an awesome time on Oxford Street every Friday night. That's what our city believes, because we're unsure whether there's a logos. But John the Apostle, who wrote this book, he starts, in the beginning was the logos, the meaning of life, and everything was created by that logos. What he's saying is that here, there is a reason to life. Your life isn't pointless. There is something to live for. This is God's world. It's not the result of blind accident. It's not the result of an accidental collection of atoms that emerged out of interaction of blind impersonal forces. No, that's not. God made the world with a purpose. He made it. There is a rationality behind everything you see. Now, that isn't the idea that is being espoused by those scientists that represent the new atheism today, is it? Richard Dawkins most famously said, "The universe we observe has precisely the properties we should expect if there are at bottom no design, no purpose, no evil and no good, nothing but blind, pitiless indifference." Now, I don't use this as an argument for Christianity, but my question is, which view of life do you prefer? You know, men and women have always cried out, why, in life? You know, we do ask why, and that's what makes it makes us different from animals. But a view of the world that says this is all there is, there's nothing more behind what you can kind of see, has no answer to that kind of question at all, which makes the view unlivable. How do you go through life thinking that there is no purpose, no meaning? I am an accident. So are you. This, all of this, just an accident. My question is, what is more livable? Now, this isn't an argument for Christianity at all. But my question is, which is more livable? And my opinion is that Christianity is much more livable. Now, that doesn't make it true, does it? Just because it's more livable, that doesn't make it true. Rather, I would say because it is true, it's livable. It isn't true because it works. That's just sentimentalism, isn't it? But because it is true, it doesn't surprise you that it actually works. And so I'm not actually trying to prove Christianity here at all. All I'm trying to say is ask you to reconsider Christianity based on this kind of picture that it is actually much, much more livable. I'm asking you to kind of come over and explore the paddock over here where the grass is greener. And I want to actually come over here and you'll actually see the grass is greener. It's not just a trick of your eyes. This world is God's world. It's not meaningless. It's the result of purpose. There is a meaning behind our universe, and this is incredibly comforting. Now, that's a bit of an excursus. I kind of got to get to Jesus' impact on science, right? We're kind of drifting into philosophy here. And the first thing we notice here is that there is reason and meaning and purpose to the universe, and that profoundly is essential for science. And a question that has baffled scientists is, how can it be that what goes on inside of our tiny heads can give us a true account of reality? And how can it be that a mathematical equation in the human mind can correspond with how the universe is out there? Now, this might not baffle you. I don't think I completely understand it, but this does baffle scientists. It was a reflection which led Einstein to say this: the only incomprehensible thing about the universe is that it is comprehensible. In other words, why is the universe intelligible at all? Atheists hold that the driving force of evolution, which eventually produced our minds, reason included, was not primarily concerned with truth at all, but with survival. And so then from an evolutionary perspective, why would we think that our minds can kind of view reality in an objectively true way when our minds evolved in order to survive? This baffles scientists. The chemist J.B.S. Haldane pointed out long ago that if the thoughts in my mind are just motions of atoms in my mind, a mechanism that has arisen by mindless, unguided processes, natural selection, which is what atheists believe, then why should I believe anything my mind tells me? Is his question, including the fact that it's made of atoms. This is a massive, massive dilemma for atheists. In other words, if, as Richard Dawkins suggests, we're the product of mindless, unguided natural processes, then he has given us strong reasons to doubt the reliability of our thinking. Now, this is quite interesting. Christians believe, though, in the rationality of God. That is, that a rational God made a rational world that can be understood. It isn't an accident. It hasn't flown into existence. The reason there's order in the world, the reason that there are rules, is that God is a God of order. And therefore, there's a rational basis for science. Now, the scientists are talking about this quite a lot. There's a German philosopher, Robert Spayman, and he's pointed out that if there is no God, then there can be no science. One of the most eminent philosophers in Germany today, he says, if there's no God, there can be no science. He's not suggesting atheists can't do science. Rather, he's saying if we eliminate God, there's no rational basis for our science. Contrast this with John chapter 1. In the beginning was the Logos. The Logos was with God. The Logos was God. He was with God in the beginning. And through him, all things were made. And without him, nothing was made that has been made. The Bible gives coherent explanation for why the world is coherently together and scientifically intelligible. Now, it's quite interesting. Modern science, therefore, it didn't arise out of Eastern religions, which have always taught that the created world is an illusion. Right? What I'm doing here is we're doing worldview analysis. How is it that people look at the world? Atheists look at the world and they think just blind collection of atoms, no rhyme, no reason. And if that's the case, how is it that we can intelligibly understand what's going on in the world if there's no reason to it? Eastern religions, they see the world as an illusion. And as a result, modern science never arose out of an Eastern religiously society. Because if reality is an illusion, why would you study it? Doesn't make sense. More than that, modern science didn't rise out of pantheism. This is quite interesting. Worldview, pantheism, pan meaning many, theism meaning gods, so many gods. Modern science didn't arise out of pantheism. Now, why is that? Well, it's interesting, you know, if there are more than one God, then that makes there more than one power at work in our universe. And if there are more than one power, multiple powers, then how could you have certainty when looking at the world? You wouldn't have certainty, as there wouldn't be any consistency. You wouldn't be able to predict anything. You know, one God may come down and do something in our world and that'll make something happen, but then another God may come down and do something completely different. And so there's no consistency to life on earth. And so if our world is populated by many gods, then you're not going to examine the world for consistent laws. Rather, what you're going to do is you're going to go to temples and appease those many gods whom you can't understand or control. That's why in kind of the superstitious, pantheistic cultures in the world, if you get sick or your crops fail, what do? You don't study agriculture and you don't study medicine. You go to the temple because you need to appease the gods who have caused this thing to happen, and you need to make sure that this doesn't happen again. See, modern science didn't arise out of that kind of worldview, nor did it arise out of Islam, despite the Arab world holding on to the only copies of Aristotle between 500 AD and 1100 AD. Does that surprise you? It surprised me when I first heard about this when I was studying history at college. You know, the Western world lost Aristotle between 500 and 1100 AD. No Aristotle, very little of the Greek philosophers, and Islam, the other ones pouring over Aristotle. And yet, Islam didn't produce modern science. Why? I think, I was reading this week, one writer suggests because of its fatalistic view of the world. That is that Allah has determined every single thing that's happened. The future is unchangeable. And therefore, why would you study what happens on earth, because things are unchangeable? You know, here are a bunch of kind of worldviews that by their very assumption of how the world is, provide very arid ground for science to grow in. Those cultures, those views of the world, it didn't produce science because they are hostile to scientific exploration. Now, science as we know it exploded onto the world stage in Europe in the 16th and 17th centuries, and the history is very easy to read. Pick up one of those books. But the question is, why then and why there? It's often called Whitehead's thesis. Whitehead was one of the greatest historians and philosophers of science. And in one of his books, he observes that medieval Europe in 1500 AD knew less than Archimedes in the 3rd century BC. Modern Europe knew less than Archimedes in the 3rd century BC. And yet, Whitehead shows, by 1700, Newton had written his masterpiece, Principia Mathematica, I can't do Latin, right? Principles of Mathematics, right? And Whitehead said, how do you get such a rapid expansion of scientific knowledge in just 200 years? How do you get that? What explains that rapid expansion of scientific knowledge from less knowledge than Archimedes in the 3rd century BC to Principia Mathematica, or whatever it is, I can't do Latin. Right, and this is his answer, right? Alfred Whitehead, one of the greatest historians of science. This is what he says. I think it's in your outlines. He says, modern science must come from the medieval insistence on the rationality of God. My explanation is that the faith in the possibility of science generated antecedently to the development of modern scientific theory in an unconscious derivative from medieval theology. C.S. Lewis, he says it much more succinctly. He says, men became scientific because they expected law in nature. And they expected law in nature because they believed in a lawgiver. Let me say that again. C.S. Lewis, he says, men became scientific because they expected law in nature. What made them expect that? And they expected law in nature because they believed in the lawgiver. Right, so here we have a rational God. Point two, we have reliable laws. It's what convinced Francis Bacon, regularly regarded as the father of modern science. It led him to teach that God has provided us with two books, the book of nature and the book of the Bible, and that to be really properly educated, one should give one's mind to studying both. There is a rational God, and there are reliable laws at work in the war, and many of the towering figures of science agreed. This history's been taken away from the church, and we need to remember it. Men such as Galileo, Kepler, Pascal, Boyle, Newton, Faraday, Babbage, Mendel, Pasteur, Kelvin, Clerk Maxwell were theists, if not most of them Christians. Far from the belief in God hindering science, it was the motor which got modern scientific industry going. Now, Galileo is often brought up at this point to kind of discredit this history and as used as an example of the church persecuting the scientists and really being against scientific knowledge. Here's the thing, Galileo believed in God, probably was a Christian. He wasn't an agnostic or an atheist, and he wasn't at loggerheads with the theism of his day. There's a brilliant biography called Galileo's Daughter, which effectively debunks the myth that Galileo was a renegade who scoffed at the Bible. It just isn't true in history, and yet Dawkins cites it as historical fact, unaware of the true history. It turns out Galileo was a firm believer in the Bible and remained that all his life. And this is what he held. He held that the laws of nature are written by the hand of God. The laws of nature written by the hand of God in the language of mathematics. As Galileo, he was sponsored by the church. And yet he was vigorously opposed by philosophers, not because of his heliocentric view of the sun being at the center of the solar system. He was opposed because he was getting rid of Aristotle's worldview. And the philosophers of the day committed to Aristotle said, "We're not getting rid of Aristotle, therefore you're wrong, Galileo." First of all, Galileo, he was opposed by the scientists. Galileo brought his ideas to the church. The church asked the scientists, "What do you think of Galileo's ideas?" And the scientists regrettably said, no, he's wrong." Quite regrettably. Galileo responds kind of unwisely, if you know the story. He responds in one of his books by representing the Pope of the Catholic Church as a dull-witted character called Simplicio, which just means simple-minded. So he does himself absolutely no favours, right? Regrettably, the church does use their power to muzzle Galileo. But contrary to popular belief, he was never tortured, and he was arrested. He was placed in house arrest, where he spent most of his life in luxurious private residences belonging to his friends. You know, the church has to reclaim history at this point and actually tell the true story. Galileo's Daughter. There's a little brilliant biography that presents the mythical nature of the Galileo incident. Any of these books will go there as well. Now, the other guy worth noting here was Isaac Newton, who also viewed these kind of reliable laws at work in the world as being written by the hand of God. And Newton, when he discovered the laws of gravitation, he didn't make the mistake, "Now I have the laws of gravity, I don't need God." That's not how he responded. He wrote the most famous book in the history of science, Principles of Mathematics, and he expressed the hope in that book that it'd persuade thinking men to believe in a creator. Fascinating. Newton could see what many people aren't able to see today, that God and science aren't alternative explanations. God is the agent who designs and upholds the universe and the mechanisms at work in the universe. Now, Richard Dawkins thinks this is kind of ludicrous, and he thinks that actually Darwin, when he discovered natural selection, we finally got rid of the need to use God as an agent to answer why there is anything at all. We don't need God to answer that. We've got natural selection, this mechanism that tells us why we have what we have. And this is what he says. He says, I'm getting lost. I'm trying to skip a little bit of stuff. Well, you kind of got to understand the background, all right? The background is William Paley, a couple of hundred years ago, right? William Paley comes up with this idea of a watchmaker. Have you heard of this, some of you? William Paley comes up with the idea of a watchmaker, and he says this: "Suppose I found a watch on the ground, and it should be inquired how the watch happened to be in that place. He concludes the watch must have a maker. And he says, so too with the world. If we find that our world is uniquely designed to support life, there must be a designer. But along comes Darwin, and he discovers this idea of natural selection, and Dawkins says, well, here we have it. Here's the mechanism by which the world was created. We don't need to believe in God anymore. And so he says, Dawkins, the only watchmaker in nature is the blind forces of physics. Now, this is absurd, and you actually see here Dawkins' misunderstanding of philosophy. Lots of writers have criticized Dawkins very heavily in the area of philosophy because he makes what philosophers call here a category mistake. Just because there are impersonal principles according to which the universe works does not mean there isn't a personal creator who designed and upholds the universe. Let me give you an example. Right, I'm in the kitchen and Maisie comes up to me and says, Dad, why is the kettle boiling? And I say, well, darling, that kettle is connected to an electricity supply. And the electricity runs into the kettle. I've got to probably show a little bit of engineering inability here as well. I think this is how a kettle works, right? Yeah, the electricity runs into the kettle. It heats an element. Is that right? Yes. Okay, good. It heats an element. The element, by conduction, heats the water in the kettle. The atoms in the water start getting agitated, and the result is the water boils. There you go, Maisie. That's why the kettle is boiling. Right, baffled, Maisie turns to Liz, who's much more sensible, and she says, Mom, why is the kettle boiling? And my wife says, because I'm making a cup of tea for your husband, for Toby and myself. Now, here's the difference. This is the difference between mechanism and agency. All right? John Lennox does this in one of his books. He says, this is the mechanism of there's a mechanism which is the blind, impersonal forces of electricity and conduction, and probably a whole bunch of other science going on there. And those forces are blind, indifferent. All right? There is that mechanism. But to conclude that that mechanism proves there is no designer behind it, there is no person who flicked the switch and created the kettle and is boiling a cup of tea for their husband, that is to make a category mistake. There is a difference between agency and mechanism. The existence of mechanism, which is what Darwin describes for us in his works on natural selection, the existence of mechanism does not imply there is no agent behind the mechanism. This is what most theologians today believe. Darwin describes well the mechanism, but to understand agency, you have to leave science behind because science cannot answer the question of agency. The existence of a mechanism, say an engine that drives a Ford car, is not an argument for disbelieving in the existence of Henry Ford, who designed the engine. Is this making sense? But often a category mistake is made, and mechanism is used by the new atheist to disprove God. It's nothing like that. You see, when Newton formulated his laws of motion, he didn't say, marvelous. Now we know how it works. We don't need God. He didn't do that. He actually said the opposite. Isn't this world so sophisticated and beautiful that it operates by these beautiful laws? Shouldn't we worship God all the more? And so to go back to Lewis's point, which is what he gets from the philosopher of science, Whitehead, men became scientific because they expected law in nature. And they expected law in nature because they believed in a lawgiver. They have rational God, reliable laws, and now we come to unreliable humans. Have a look at verse 9. The true light that gives light to everyone was coming into the world. He was in the world, and though the world was made through him, the world didn't recognize him. He came to that which was his own, but his own did not receive him. Here we see another factor of relevance to the rise of science, and it's the doctrine of sin. Now, this kind of surprised me. This is what Peter Harrison discusses in this book, The Fall of Man and the Foundations of Science. He attributes the foundations of modern science to the Protestant reclamation of the universal human sinfulness of people. In verse 10, what we see here is that our world did not and still does not recognize God. Right? When God became a man, they didn't recognize him. And to be honest, nor would we. Because we all prefer to live under the illusion that we're free to do as we please. We don't want to answer to God, and so we live under the illusion that he doesn't exist, or if he does exist, he doesn't expect anything from us. Now, even those who believe in the existence of God, we treat God this way, as though he doesn't exist all the time. I do, and you do. And the Bible calls this sin. Now, this is fascinating. The doctrine of sin was taken very seriously in the 16th century by the Protestant reformers. And this is what they said. They said this desire to live under the illusion that God doesn't rule the world, this desire to kind of see ourselves as the most important things in the world, this desire, this sinfulness affects every one of our faculties, including our minds. And the result is that they stopped trusting human reason as a valid means of coming to the truth. The Greek philosophy of the day, they said, yeah, us in our brains, we can understand the world without having to test anything. Along come Protestant reformers and say, heck no, we're a bunch of sinful people where we twist the truth and we twist reason to suit our own ends. And the result is that the Protestant reformers, they started making sure that whatever truth was espoused, that there would be evidence for it. I mean, just look at the history of science. Have there ever been scientists who faked experiments to suit their own desires? It happens. And the Protestant reformers expected that and said, that's universal. That's going to happen. And as a result, they said, therefore, any view of the world must be backed up by experiments. And as a result, we saw modern science arise. Okay, that's unreliable humans. And finally, we see here a redeemable world. We see a rational God as the basis of science. If God is rational, then we can actually understand the world he's placed us in. If he's rational, there are reliable laws at work in our world. An atheist doesn't have that. Why would there be reliable laws, constancy in nature with which to observe? There is no reason for that in a naturalistic worldview. Christianity brings that. Thirdly, unreliable humans. Christianity brought this idea, we're naturally sinful. We're going to twist the evidence to suit our own, and so everything must be tested. And then fourthly and finally, a redeemable world. Look at verse 14. The Word became flesh and made his dwelling among us. We have seen his glory, the glory of the one and only Son who came from the Father, full of grace and truth. The gospel teaches that Jesus is God come to rescue us from the darkness of our own sinfulness. God hasn't abandoned the world. And despite what's going on in your life this week, God hasn't abandoned you. The essence of the Christian message is that God hasn't abandoned this world in spite of its darkness. God so loved the world that he gave his Son for it to redeem it. God's world, yes, this is God's world. He made it. It's rational. You can observe it. But it has fallen into darkness. It has sinned, rebelled against him, and it's cursed it's evil, it's foul, and it's full of darkness. But he has not given up on it. And this led the Protestant reformers to go out and start observing the world and to see that what God originally made in the world is very good, and that what we have created in the world is not very good at all. And God is still concerned about the world. The astonishing fact is that the Logos, who is with God, who was God, who was in the beginning with God, he became flesh and dwelt among us. What a remarkable idea that the meaning of life is a person who came and walked into our world with teeth and toenails, so that the meaning of life is not some abstract principle that we kind of conjure up in our minds, but a person we meet in the pages of Scripture and who will come again one day. You know, this is fascinating. This indicates God's concern and interest for the world. People look at history, and we look at history, we look at the news this week, and we say there's absolutely no sense, no meaning. Everything's going round and round. Things are getting worse. But that isn't the case. You look at the Christian story, you look at the history of the world, and you see what God has done. The Logos became flesh and tangible and a person for you and for me. You know, it's fascinating that the Logos became a human being by a miracle of virgin birth, and he exited the world by the miracle of resurrection. And you may ask me, well, doesn't that seem to go against the grain of science? You know, aren't miracles impossible because they violate the laws of nature? And I'm going to finish on this because I think this is important to understand. You know, aren't miracles such as a virgin birth and a resurrection antithetical to science? David Hume put that view forward a couple hundred years ago. And this is how C.S. Lewis responds to it, quite ingeniously. He says, look, if on each of two nights I put £10 into my drawer, he's English, right? If on two nights I put £10 into my drawer, the laws of arithmetic tell me I have £20. If, however, on waking up I only find £5 in the drawer, I don't conclude that the laws of arithmetic have been broken, but possibly do the laws of England. The laws of nature describe to us the regularities on which the universe normally runs. God, who created the universe with those laws, is no more their prisoner than the thief is the prisoner of the laws of arithmetic. Like my room, Lewis says, the universe is not a closed system, as the secularist, the atheist, maintains. God can, if he wills, do something special like raise Jesus from the dead. You understand what Lewis is saying there? He says, don't miracles, aren't they completely unscientific? And he says, no, let's have a look at the laws of arithmetic. If I put £10 in my drawer, and then the second night £10, come back, and there's only £5 there, what do I conclude? I don't conclude that the laws of nature have been broken. I conclude that the laws of England have been broken, and that a thief has come into the room and taken them out of it. And he says the same is true of our world. God is not a prisoner to the laws he set up in the world, and it is entirely possible for him to come into the world and do as he please. Similarly, you know, we understand the laws at work in our world, that dead people do not come back from the dead. And we could only say that it is a law of nature that no one rises from the dead by natural processes. But Christians don't claim that Jesus rose by natural processes, but by supernatural power. The laws of nature cannot rule out that possibility, that God comes into the world and does something particularly special. And as a result, you cannot rule out the possibility of a miracle. And this is the miracle. God came into the world by the virgin birth, into a world of darkness and death, a world falling apart, a world still rational and observable, but a world falling apart. And he died for that world to redeem it, which gives incredible value to the world. And he rose again from the dead. Two outstanding miracles in which God intervenes into our world to bring hope and life. Here are a couple of the impacts of Jesus on science in history. A rational God, reliable laws, unreliable people, we test what people do, and a redeemable world. God saw fit to redeem our world. Christians believe that. Christians believe the world is good. And as a result, Christians love studying the world. So if you're a scientist, Kirsty Elwell, Robert Wood, all the others of you, you're in a good profession. Anyway, that's all I got for you. Ignore anything wrong I said about science. I apologize, but I hope you've seen some of the theology, which is the fertile ground from which science sprung.